Thank you, Chase. Yes, we're spending our time in the first half of chapter 4 of 1 Peter. We have just invested in some clocks for our children, not just because we want to them to learn the time, which we do, but also because we want to make some attempt at regulating their movements, ideally before 7 o'clock in the morning. It may well be a futile attempt, at least in the case of my daughter, who is somewhat resistant to any form of regulation. Her mother abdicates all responsibility for that. But so far, it seems to have done the trick with my son, so that when the big hand reaches 12 and the little hand reaches 7, every day, like clockwork, you can cue the pitter-patter of the feet down the hallway, down to the toilet, and so on. Not a moment before, to our great relief, and not a moment later. Time, or more to the point, an awareness of time can be a great incentive to our behaviour, can't it? It's nothing like a clock to inspire a sense of motivation, or sometimes perhaps a sense of dread, depending on the closeness of the essay deadline. Or, I know this might surprise you, the marking deadline. It's a funny thing about time, isn't it? On the one hand, it can be a great incentive to action, focusing our minds on what we need to do, providing meaning and direction to our daily activity, especially if you're a procrastinator like me. On the other hand, it's capable of inducing great fear and panic, isn't it? Which ironically can actually be quite a disincentive to action. I'm sure you know what it's like to have 20 minutes to go in an exam and you just feel paralysed by the clock as you despair at how little you've written of any real substance. This is an anxiety-inducing sermon. I'm sorry about that. So time, or at least a sense of time, the clock, it's a funny thing. It can either lead to a great deal of action and purposeful productivity or a crippling fear-induced paralysis. Now, in this passage, we're picking up this letter of the Apostle Peter at chapter 4. Peter points his readers, he points us to the clock, to God's timetable for human history. And you see that there in verse 7. The end of all things is near, he says. Time's nearly up. Human history as we know it is coming to an end. Now, what's he doing here? Is Peter just another one of those sort of crazy bearded end times preachers who's kind of using the clock to scare us, to paralyze us in fear and despair? You know, when people start barking on about end times, it can become a little oppressive after a while, can't it? You can sort of just tune out after a while. But of course, what Peter is doing here is very different. He's not trying to scare us. A Christian has no need to fear the end. The end is our hope. It's our glorious future. It's our salvation, as he puts it back in chapter 1. So if Peter is not trying to scare us by reminding us of the time, what is he doing? Well, he points to the clock, I think, as a great incentive to living an authentic, productive Christian life in a hostile world. You may remember that he's written this letter to Christians scattered throughout modern-day Turkey, and he writes to them as aliens, as sojourners, called to live as strangers in this world, in spite of all the hostility and persecution that they have faced, or more likely, are about to face. And his great concern in this passage this morning is that if we lose the time, if we lose a sense of God's timetable for human history, we will simply drift back into pagan self-indulgence. He wants us to keep our eyes on the clock. The end of all things is near. And essentially, there's two instructions. We need to stop wasting time and start redeeming time. And then finally, he gives us the weapon that we need for this battle. So first of all, we'll skip over verses 1 and 2, we'll come back to those at the end. But have a look at verse 3. You've spent enough time in the past doing what pagans choose to do. The picture there is of lost time, of wasted time, of dead time. You've wasted enough time, he says, in debauchery, lust, drunkenness, orgies, carousing, and detestable idolatry, living for evil human desires, verse 2, rather than the will of God. See, if nothing else, sin is it's a real waste of time, isn't it? I don't know how much you've reflected on that, the sheer wastefulness, the pointlessness of sin. Peter spoke about this back in chapter 1, where he talks about the empty, futile way of life from which we have been redeemed by the precious blood of Christ. It's interesting here in verse 3. He doesn't zero in on the more obvious problems in our world: war, injustice, genocide, people smuggling, slavery, and so on. No, he zeroes in on those places where every day greed and violence are at once both hidden and revealed in the very normal, mundane, banal habits of self-indulgence. This word debauchery or licentiousness is what we in the liberal West call freedom, isn't it? By which, of course, we simply mean the reckless, unstoppable reign of our own desires. Not only, but certainly not least, our sexual desires. In the West, freedom is a euphemism to treat sex as a product on a shelf in a newsagent, or on a computer screen, or in some shady parlour. An end in itself, something to be consumed simply because you want it or you need it, without any regard for the person, the relationship, the covenant, the children, the social order. It's a commodification of sex that has essentially ruined love, as one writer has put it. So that what was once a good, God-given appetite to be enjoyed in the service of love in a marriage is now an absolute necessity to be grasped at, to be worshipped, even at the expense of love itself. Lusts, those insatiable cravings that call for nothing short of immediate gratification, whatever the cost, leaving the family courts and the abortion clinics to clean up the mess in the wake. Drunkenness, orgies, carousing, that endless, mindless consumption of alcohol and food and bodies and goods and property, consumed and then chucked out or destroyed without any regard for the consequences or the common good. Detestable idolatry, that's the essence of it, isn't it? Worship of the creature rather than the creator. You see, when human desire ceases to find its end in the will and design of its maker, it ceases to have any end at all, doesn't it? It simply is. It simply desires. It listens to nothing other than itself. You take away the true end for which human appetites were made, the infinite, eternal God, and all you're left with is human appetite itself, which begins to take on and assume infinite, unstoppable proportions. Always seeking, never finding. Always consuming, never being satisfied. Always working, but never resting. And so what pretends at freedom is really just this hopeless, endless cycle of slavery. And it's like the world is asleep, sleepwalking in the swill of lost time, in utter mindless, self-indulgent denial of its maker and judge, the judge who will, as Peter says in verse 5, at his appointed time, bring down the curtains on this mess and call all people to their knees. But you, Peter says, have spent enough time doing what pagans choose to do. And isn't that a word we need to hear too? In his book, Civilization, the historian Niall Ferguson, he talks about the way that the word ethic of the Reformation, as he calls it, slightly adapting Max Weber's famous phrase, where the Reformation's emphasis on the word of God in people's hands, in their native tongues, led to a growth in education, a greater sense of personal responsibility and delayed gratification, all the ingredients that lead to healthy, growing, stable economies that have been enjoyed in the West for the past few hundred years and more recently in places where missionaries have gone with the gospel. And Ferguson talks about the way this word ethic culture has been almost entirely undone in the space of just 50 years since the early days of the sexual revolution in the 60s. where personal responsibility and restraint and thrift have so quickly been replaced by the rampant celebration of self, of pleasure, of free love and freedom from any kind of dogma and repression. Just 50 years. What Peter reminds us in this letter, though, I think, is that when it comes to human history, this mindless, wasteful, decadent idolization of the self is actually the norm. It's always been the norm in the ancient world as it is today. The word, ethic, culture of the centuries following the Reformation is, if anything, a blip rather than the norm. And now just look how quickly it's taken to return to the status quo. Just 50 years. And this is the normal polluted air we breathe. The same polluted air breathed in by Peter's audience. And we're kidding ourselves if we sort of imagine that we're somehow immune to its asphyxiating power. In fact, in his book, Ferguson points to the apparent contradiction that with the general decline of Christian culture in North America, evangelicalism seems to be on the rise. How can that be? Well, we'd like to say, of course, that it's because the gospel's been going out and people have been converted and saved, but Ferguson is more cynical than that. He suspects that what passes for evangelical Christianity, much of it at least, is too often more than just a kind of Christianized parody of the self-indulgent world in which it is immersed. And so he talks about a kind of a Walmart cinema Christianity that makes very few demands on its followers, while its followers make a great many demands on God to satisfy all their personal needs, so that God, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit has effectively been displaced, he says, by God the analyst, God the agony aunt, and God the personal trainer. Now, it'd be easy to point the finger at a brand of North American TV evangelicalism as this is never going to be our issue. But part of the problem, I think, with the kind of seduction Peter's talking about is that it's mindless. It's lost control of its senses. And therefore, you may not even know it's happening to you, let alone how serious it is. Now, some of you will know what it's like to be harassed by cranky missionaries back on home assignment, and it can be a bit annoying, I admit. But why is it that missionaries all too often return home to find themselves so discouraged by what they see? Isn't it because they might have come from a place where the Christians they've known have been hungry and zealous for the word, eager to serve? Not perfect, but honest and deliberate in resisting sin and temptation, perhaps even at great personal cost, sacrifice, only then to return home and find the Christians they see asleep at the switch, apathetic, self-indulgent, demanding rather than serving, careless about sin, all too alike those around us. The mindlessness of sin seduction means we may not even be able to see it until someone else comes and points it out to us. Well, Peter says, you've spent enough time doing what pagans choose to do, that secret lust or addiction that serves no good end, that turns you in on yourself, that eats away at your resources, that treats other people as objects, that erodes your capacity for real love with real people. You've wasted enough time on it. That gnawing ambition for popularity, for approval, for power, for comfort, as let's face it, so often drives much of our busyness in our studies and even our ministry, and yet so threatens to corrupt it and turn it into a self-serving sham. You've wasted enough time on it. And I dread to think how much time and energy and imagination and creativity I have invested in myself that I could have invested in students. Just imagine how long the emails would be. Love your neighbour as yourself. Love your neighbour as yourself. Just imagine what kind of world we would have if people took that command seriously. But that is our calling, brothers and sisters. Notice that verse 8. We'll come back to that in a moment. And of course, the more we live up to this calling, the stranger we look. Verse 4, they think it's strange that you do not plunge in with them into the same flood of dissipation and they heap abuse on you. people around us are like fish submerged in a filthy sea of self-indulgence. And the water is so normal, and the clear air outside looks so strange and menacing to those who swim in this sea. They think it strange that you don't plunge in. And that's the way it will be. And of course, we're increasingly starting to say that these days, as if we're just waking up to it, that the further the West descends from the culture created by the word ethic of the gospel, the stranger and more menacing we will look. We're no longer just the sandal-wearing wowsers. We're now a dangerous threat to the morality of self-indulgence and the commissars of this new religion. And that's the way it will be. It's the way it must be. Because as Peter says earlier in the letter, we have been redeemed from this empty way of life by the precious blood of Christ. So Peter says, stop wasting time. We are to be people who have our eyes fixed on the clock. The end of all things is near. The judge is coming. But he also shows us how we can start redeeming the time. What does it look like to have your eyes on the clock? And he gives us a beautiful picture here in verses 8 to 11. And wouldn't it be great to meditate on this more deeply than we can in our time now? But just let's just take a bit of a look. How can we start redeeming the time? Well, it's as simple as this. Rather than chiefly investing in yourself, you chiefly invest in others. The essence of it is summed up there in verse 8. Above all, love each other earnestly, since love covers a multitude of sins. Now, I have to admit, I find this a bit of a troubling verse. I have all kinds of people in my life, as you do, and I'm not just talking about people I know, Christian people with whom I presently have some relationship, not strangers. Love one another earnestly, zealously, intentionally. That's the sense of what he's saying there, since love covers a multitude of sins. There's a small number of my brothers and sisters with whom that command is relatively easy to practice, partly because of my affection for them, and that aids my commitment to them. My love for them is not perfect, but it's more or less consistently zealous. I'm invested in their welfare. I might even go under a bus for them. I won't tell you who those people are. I don't want anyone getting anxious. Actually, I will. It's the faculty, of course. And there's a much larger group of brothers and sisters whose company I genuinely enjoy. But for whom those affections are not as strong. Don't worry. So love requires more effort. It's more reactive than proactive. It's driven by circumstance and duty rather than deliberate intention so much of the time. And then there are small numbers where the desire, the will, the affections are simply not there. If not at times even working in the opposite direction of love. It might just be a relatively minor irritation, personality clash. But sometimes it's because of real betrayal and hurt that's left a callous imprint in my body. And I admit this because I'm sure I'm not simply speaking for myself. But more to the point, a verse like this unsettles me. Because when you come to a verse like this, don't you find that your immediate instinct is to sort of make qualifications? Love one another earnestly. Oh, well, that can't possibly mean everyone. I can't love everyone deeply. My family, they have to come first, and then there are my friends. But I can't be friends with everybody. I click with some people more than others, and then some people live closer to me than others, and then there are the people who, I have responsibility for in my ministries, you know, and I've got limited capacities, and I don't want to burn out, so I have to be selective. Love covers over a multitude of sins. Oh, yes, 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 yes. But, we don't want to sweep sin under the carpet. It's right to pull people up when they've been ungodly, isn't it? And people hurt us, and that has to affect our relationships, surely. And it takes time for things to heal. And then sometimes people are unrepentant and when they hurt us and say, then what does love look like then? And so it goes on. All of those qualifications may be wise and necessary, but notice Peter doesn't make any qualifications here, does he? Love is patient. Love is kind. Love is not envious or boastful or arrogant or rude. It does not insist in its own way. It is not irritable or resentful. does not rejoice in wrongdoing, but rejoices in the truth. It bears all things, believes all things, hopes all things, endures all things. No qualifications. Lord, how often shall I forgive my brother? Peter said, 7 times? No, I tell you, not 7 times, but 70 times 7. No qualifications. We could point to our New Testament reading from 1 John 4. Same thing. No qualifications. But we rush to make qualifications, don't we? And in doing so, we can evade the real challenge of this call to love widely, indiscriminately, zealously. And we can evade the real pain that is involved in genuine forgiveness and restoration of relationships. And we just carry on as we always have and file this verse away in the drawer. And brothers and sisters, feel the challenge of this exhortation in your life, in your own circumstances, before rushing to make qualifications. Well, Peter gives us 2 applications of this challenge here, and let's just glance at them briefly. He says, verse 9, offer hospitality to one another without grumbling. Hospitality. That doesn't just mean the occasional dinner party for friends. It means open homes, open hands, open hearts. A willingness to share what we have been given for brothers and sisters in need, even at the risk of being abused, without grumbling. I remember when I was in parish ministry before I was married, and there was a young fellow new to church who fell out badly with his parents, and he needed a place to stay for a while, so I thought I'd do my duty and let him come and stay with me in my flat for a while. And within days, he was driving me up the wall. He didn't conform to my standards of hygiene. The poor fellow was totally nocturnal. It was a small flat, and we were soon on top of each other, and to my shame, I started to grumble. There's a very important place for duty in the Christian life. We have a duty to our families, we have a duty to those who employ us, to our congregations, and not least to God himself. And we ought to embrace those duties willingly, faithfully. But mere duty for duty's sake, or worse still, a kind of duty crafted for appearances or self-congratulation, which carps and grumbles behind closed doors. Let's not kid ourselves. That's less than what real love should be. And of course, this is going to be harder the more stressed we are. The closer the deadlines, the closer the exams. Show hospitality without grumbling. A philoxenoi that overcomes the xenophobia that is all around us. And then secondly and finally, we love through participating in the economy of God's grace. Each of you have a gift, verse 10. God didn't give it to you for your self-esteem, for your ego, or even for your, chiefly for your ministry employment. He gave it to you to use for service. Whatever gift you have, it's been entrusted to you in stewardship for others. So that in the midst of an economy of scarcity, an economy of greed, of consumption, of hoarding, the church is to be an economy of God's grace and abundance for his glory, verse 11. So in this passage, Peter urges us to keep our eyes on the clock, God's clock. The end of all things is near. Stop wasting time through mindless investment in yourself, and start redeeming time through intentional, loving investment in others. And it's profoundly countercultural. The world thinks it's strange. But they also ought to be able to say, as people did of the Christians in the early church, see how they loved each other. I've been thinking quite a bit about the Christian life, about sanctification this year. And it strikes me that what Peter is saying here is exactly the same as Paul, when he tells us on the one hand to put to death, to mortify that which belongs to the flesh, and to put on the new self, created to be like God in true righteousness and holiness. Mortification and vivification. Stop wasting time and start redeeming time. And like Paul, Peter recognises it's a battle. It's hard. It's the way of suffering and self-denial. And I've skipped over this, but what is the weapon that God gives us for the battle? Well, have a look back at verses 1 and 2. Therefore, since Christ suffered in the body, arm yourself also with the same attitude, because whoever suffers in the body is done with sin. As a result, they do not live the rest of their earthly lives for evil human desires, but rather for the will of God. A lot of ink has been spilt on those verses. Peter may well have the Garden of Gethsemane in mind throughout this chapter, not just the cross per se. You'll see in verse 7 there, he may be alluding to Gethsemane again when he urges us to be alert so that we can pray. But think of Gethsemane. Think of Christ with his eyes on God's clock, putting aside all prospects of immediate gratification, laying aside every privilege, every prerogative, every prestige to which he was entitled, knowing exactly what he had to face in all its horror, and yet praying, "Not my will, but yours be done." For no other reason than he loved his Father and he loved us. He entrusted himself to him who judges justly, Peter says. And he says, arm yourself with the same attitude. I don't know how that makes you feel to hear that. As inspiring as Christ's example is, the thought that I might be able to copy it, that through some sort of Promethean act of willpower, I might be able to summon up all the peerless strength and purity he had in the face of temptation. Well, it's laughable to say the least. Christ's suffering is, of course, unique. And we mustn't forget that when we read this verse. It was his suffering, it was the suffering of the righteous one for the unrighteous, to bring the unrighteous like you and me to God. I confess I was struggling to find a commentary helpful on this verse, and I had to go back to the 17th century, to a commentary by Robert Layton. You've never heard of him, have you? He's the Archbishop of Glasgow in the 1670s. And he reminds us that when Christ suffered, he didn't just suffer as our rule, but as our saviour. And therefore, to arm ourselves with his attitude is not simply a call to copy him, but it's a discipline that begins first with trust, with faith, in his suffering for us in our place, with trust that Christ suffered to change us. This is some of what he writes, and I'll finish with this. We are more obliged to make his suffering our example because it was to us more than an example. It was our ransom. The pious contemplation of his death will most powerfully kill the love of sin in the soul. The believer looking on Jesus crucified for him and wounded for his transgressions and taking in deep thoughts of his spotless innocency, which deserved no such thing, and of his matchless love, which yet endured it all for them, will then naturally think, shall I be a friend to that which was his deadly enemy? Shall sin be sweet to me, which was so bitter to him? Shall I ever lend it a good look or entertain a favourable thought of that which shed my Lord's blood? Wouldst thou have power against sin and much increase of holiness, let thine eye be much on Christ. Let it dwell in him and be still with him. Wouldst thou have thy pride and passions and love of the world and self-love killed? Go sue for the virtue of his death, and that shall do it. Seek his spirit, the spirit of meekness and humility and divine love. Look on him, and he shall draw thy heart heavenward and unite it to himself and make it like himself. So, Christian friends, keep your eyes on the clock, on Christ. The end of all things is near.